guess this is a it's a reading, and also it's musings on solitude and on words. And yesterday I had a conversation with Louise Ward, and we're immersed in her exhibition here today, and we had interesting conversations bouncing backwards and forwards about her exhibition and her practice and my practice, and just accidentally or incidentally, I know that this is somehow that Louise works. I began explaining to her that I'm going through a period of trying to work on different projects and research, and that I find myself increasingly recording myself reading, and I do this for a variety of different reasons. I think initially I did it a few years back. I recorded myself with any form of recording device, actually, a video or a camera or a sound recording device, so that I could simply play back ideas, presentations, mundane, all types of different things. So it's something that I'm becoming more and more used to. So, as I said, the first reason why I did it was really to be able to, if I was reading a certain text and I found it difficult, or I really appreciated it, or I didn't like it at all, I sometimes record it, and I'm like an audience of this, and it allows me to kind of witness it in a different way. So then another thing that I find in this recent times is that in my research, and I tend to work often collaboratively, but when I'm researching a project, it's a solitary exercise, and solitude is a beautiful thing, but sometimes solitude slips into loneliness. And so there's this kind of theme of loneliness that became apparent, and I started wrestling with this idea of being lonely, and why should I be lonely, and you know, why shouldn't I be comfortable in my own presence, so I became an audience for myself, and so I've got this one aspect of myself where I'm seeking knowledge or whatever, but I'm also then being kept companioned by my creative self. And I guess that this leads me to my third reason, is that the second one is that I'm keeping myself company. And the third one is that a lot of the projects I work on tend to be often ephemeral or event-based. And so then there's this other part of me that yearns to, that wants to output more tangible, concrete pieces of work or writing, or you know, be it an art project or a curative project, or you know, really latch on. So, and I think that this mirrors working in the contemporary art environment of today. And that's that, really. So I explained to Louise that I'm doing these readings, and I had expressed to her that I really enjoyed the piece that she had written in accompaniment to this exhibition, whereby, and I said, you know what, maybe I'll just record myself doing that, at which point she said, why don't you come in and do a reading and treat it as a area, as a place to experiment. So I thought about it and I said, yes, well, why not? So here I am. So I'm going to read for you from a book, and interestingly, you can see on the computer beside me is that I've already recorded myself reading from this book. So there's this other person kind of here with us too doing this reading. I've toyed with leaving both volumes on, but I just thought for the purposes of this evening that I wouldn't do that, but I wanted to kind of witness setting it up, and now I'm actually recording it again. So I don't really, this is an experiment. and don't really want to say any more than that. And so I'm going to read out of this book, and it's a book I've simply read and something struck a chord with me. I'm not trying to make it fit in necessarily with this exhibition as such, only that, you know, it's a place for experiment, and I'm experimenting with doing these readings. So the text itself, just bear in mind that it doesn't necessarily have to correspond as such. So it's by a Russian author, and his name is Boris Groys. And he's written this book called Art Power, and really he's a commentator, an observer on visual art and its relation to society and also to institutions such as the museum. So I'm going to read out of chapter 2, and really in the way I read is I chop and change. I don't necessarily read it from start to finish, and so I might do that here. Not having really planned to do it, and I also know that there's certain time constraints. So I'm going to read just at the very beginning. In recent decades, the discourse on the impossibility of the new in art has become especially widespread and influential. Its most interesting characteristic is a certain feeling of happiness, of positive excitement about this alleged end of the new, a certain inner satisfaction that this discourse obviously produces in the contemporary cultural milieu. Indeed, this initial postmodern sorrow about the end of history is gone. Now we seem to be happy about the loss of history, of the idea of progress, of the utopian future, all things traditionally connected to the phenomenon of the new. Given that we experience art history first of all as represented in our museums, the liberation from the new, understood as liberation from art history, and for that matter, from history as such, is experienced by the art world in the first place as a chance to break out of the museum. Breaking out of the museum means becoming popular, alive, and present outside the closed walls of the established art world, outside the museum's walls. Therefore, it seems to me that the positive excitement about the end of the new in art is linked in the first place to this promise of bringing art into life, beyond all historical constructions and considerations, beyond the opposition of old and new. Artists and art theoreticians alike are glad to be free at last from the burden of history, from the necessity to make the next step, and from the obligation to conform to the historical laws and requirement of that which is historically new. Indeed, these artists and theoreticians want to be politically and culturally engaged in social reality. They want to reflect on their own cultural identity, express their individual desires, and so on. But first of all, they want to show themselves to be truly alive and real, in opposition to the abstract, dead historical constructions represented by the museum system and by the art market. It is, of course, a completely legitimate desire. But to be able to fulfil this desire to make a true living art, we have to answer the following question. When and under what conditions does art appear to be most alive? There is a deep-rooted tradition in modernity of history bashing, museum bashing, library bashing, or more generally, archive bashing in the name of real life. The library and the museum are the preferred objects of intense hatred for a majority of modern writers and artists. Rousseau admired the destruction of the famous ancient library of Alexandria. Goethe's Faust was prepared to sign a contract with the devil if he could escape the library and the obligation to read its books. In the texts of modern artists and theoreticians, the museum is repeatedly described as a graveyard of art and museum curators as grave diggers. According to this tradition, the death of the museum and of the art history embodied by the museum must be interpreted as a resurrection of true living art, as a turning towards true reality, towards the great other. However, the question I'm more interested in at this moment is, as I said, a different one. Why does art want to be alive rather than dead? And what does it mean for art to be alive, or look as if it were alive? I'll try to show that the inner logic of museum collecting itself that compels the artist to go into reality, into life, and make art that is seen as being alive, I shall also try to show that being alive means, in fact, nothing more or less than being new. Now I'm skipping forward a little bit. And then I'll conclude. We can even say that under the conditions of the modern museum, the newness of newly produced art is not established post factum as a result of comparison with old art. Rather, the comparison takes place before the emergence of the new artwork and virtually produces this new artwork. The modern artwork is collected before it is even produced. The art of the avant-garde is the art of an elitist thinking minority, not because it expresses some specific bourgeois taste, as for example Bourdieu asserts, because in a way avant-garde art expresses no taste at all, no public taste, no personal taste, not even the tastes of the artists themselves. Avant-garde art is elitist simply because it originates under a constraint to which the general public is not subjected. For the general public, all things, or at least most things, could be new because they are unknown, even if they are already collected in museums. This observation opens the way to making the central distinction necessary to achieve a better understanding of the phenomenon of the new, that between new and other, or between the new and different. And it goes on, and I think it's a very valuable chapter to read. And so really, that's it. This is what I am doing at the moment. I am making these video diaries of myself musing. I'm making these diaries of myself reading, and really they're like small, concrete, tangible output. Because I think what struck a chord with me here is that sometimes you are very solitary in the way you're working, is because there is very little audience. You have a small group of peers, but you know, it doesn't make it not valid or whatever, but that it's the there is no public. So in doing these readings, I've become my own public, and that gives me solace somewhat. And so I guess I'd also like to thank Louise for this opportunity to actually have a public in this reading, and use this reading of a text as an opportunity really to share ideas and knowledge and simply give an example of something that, you know, I happen to be reading, which will somehow feed my practice, or not feed it, or, you know,